Hamas condemns the Emirati foreign minister's remarks about the Palestinian resistance group. It says they're in line with the Israeli aspirations. The Israeli parliament is set to vote on a new coalition cabinet that could end a 12-year rule of Prime Minister Netanyahu. And hundreds of people join a funeral in the Canadian city of London to bid farewell to a Muslim family killed in a hate-motivated raid. It's a great pleasure to have you with us. Now, starting with our top story, the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has reacted to provocative comments by Foreign Minister of the United Arab Emirates, Sheikh Abdullah bin Zayed Al Nahyan. The Hamas spokesman said in a tweet that remarks made by the top Emirati diplomat are in line with the Israeli regime's aspirations and false accounts. Hazem Qasem added that the comments also run counter to approaches and viewpoints of Arab nations supporting the resistance front in occupied Palestine. In his recent comments, Al Nahyan expressed regret that a number of countries have not put movements such as Hamas on their list of terrorist groups. He also expressed hope that a normalization of ties between Abu Dhabi and Tel Aviv would pave the way for other Arab states to follow suit. The Israeli parliament is set to vote on a new coalition cabinet that could end the 12-year rule of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. The Knesset vote will either see a fragile eight-party alliance to power or return Israel to a stalemate and possibly a fifth general election since 2019. The new coalition consists of parties ranging from the right-wing Yamina Party to Arab lawmakers. It's already selected centrist politician Yair Lapid and ultranationalist Naftali Bennett to serve as premier for 2 years each. After Netanyahu's failure to form a cabinet following an inconclusive March election, Lapid was tasked with forming a coalition. Netanyahu was already facing a host of corruption charges. Israelis have held a number of protest rallies recently against Netanyahu over his handling of COVID-19 and the economy. Now from Ramallah, let's bring in our correspondent. Mona Kendall is there. Yeah, she knows all about this. Mona, good to have you with us. So tell us more about what's going on in the Israeli government and also if it really makes any difference to the Palestinians.
Well, as you were saying, today in the afternoon hours, the Israeli Knesset, the parliament, would convene in order to vote on the coalition cabinet that was presented by Naftali Bennett, a far-right politician leading Yamina Party, and Yair Lapid, a centrist and opposition leader of Yish Atid Party. This means if the Israeli coalition cabinet received all the needed votes from the Israeli Knesset, this means that Netanyahu will his term in office would end after 12 years, especially that this is the first time Israeli lawmakers succeeded to form a coalition cabinet after four inconclusive parliamentary elections in 2 years and after Netanyahu's repeated failure to form a coalition. Now, in the afternoon hours, there would be speeches for Netanyahu, for Lapid, and Naftali Bennett. Up till the moment, Netanyahu is trying to convince some parties within the Israeli cabinet, those who are against Bennett and Lapid, in order not to give their votes for the coalition cabinet. But up till the moment, experts are saying that despite there is assurances from some of the Israeli parties to Lapid and Bennett that they would vote in favor of the coalition cabinet. However, Netanyahu is well known for being a person who continues to deceive others, and especially that he issued numerous statements accusing Lapid and his coalition cabinet that it would be a leftist government, it will not serve the Israelis. For the Palestinians, nothing might change but changing the officials. Netanyahu will go, other Israeli officials will come. However, at the same time, they believe that this upcoming cabinet might be even more extreme, more radical, especially that Bennett is well known for his statements against the Palestinians, for the cabinet's rejection of forming a Palestinian, or allowing for the establishment of a Palestinian state, and they will continue to support settlements. They believe that all settlements in the occupied territories and in the West Bank is part of Israel, and they are seen as Israeli cities, not illegal settlements being built on private Palestinian lands.
Okay, thank you very much for that. Mona Candela, correspondent in Ramallah. Now, as the G7 summit reaches the climax in Cornwall, a day of rage and action for Palestine has been underway to condemn world leaders for lack of action in protecting Palestinians from the Israeli aggression. Protests took place up and down the UK, but in London, thousands mobilized outside Downing Street demanding change. Robert Carter has a report.
As the G7 descended on Cornwall for the summit, thousands of passionate pro-Palestine protesters amassed outside Downing Street in central London on Saturday to vent their anger over ongoing Israeli crimes against the Palestinians.
These protesters are absolutely furious at the lack of action from world leaders following Israel's recent and relentless attacks on Gaza and the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. Although a ceasefire has been agreed since then, the fact that Palestinians are still forced to live under an apartheid regime has bitterly fueled the anger of these protesters who want to force a change.
Protesters had various demands, including international recognition of the Palestinian state and an end to Israeli arms sales.
If arms are used in violation of international law, they must be banned, embargoed immediately. Also, the issue of settlement products, they must be banned immediately. Those are illegal products. The recognition of the state of Palestine is long overdue. We do not understand why the UK government is not even listening to the voices of its own people, the voices of its own parliament that voted overwhelmingly to recognize the state of Palestine. The lack of recognition is not only immoral, it is undemocratic.
Place an embargo on Israel. Stop the arms deal. So this is the message that we're sending to. The people are with us. We're in our thousands. And we are going to continue until, honestly, the Palestinians are free and occupation is ended.
We are not going to forget the mark of shame upon the history of this country that brought us to where we are today, the Balfour Declaration. We demand a public apology from the British government, as well as recognition of our state of Palestine. On top of that, we want sanctions now. We want justice. We want action.
The bombs may have temporarily stopped falling, but while Israel's systematic discrimination against the Palestinian people continues, so will the protests. Robert Carter, London.
At least 18 people have been killed and several more wounded in separate artillery attacks on the northern Syrian town of Afrin. The first raid hit a residential area, and a second one targeted a hospital shortly afterward. A local Turkish official cited hospital sources as saying that a Kurdish YPG militant hit the building with a missile. The official said that the Turkish artillery units shelled rural positions near the city of Ma'arat al-Numan in response. Ankara views the U.S.-backed YPG as a terrorist organization. In 2019, it launched a cross-border operation in neighboring Syria under the pretext of pushing the YPG-affiliated forces away from its borders. Hundreds of people have joined a funeral in the Canadian city of London to bid farewell to a Muslim family killed in a hate-motivated attack. The mourners paid tribute to the four victims as they gathered at the city's Islamic Center. They held a procession before laying the victims' bodies to rest. The ceremony was broadcast live on major Canadian networks. The family members were deliberately run over by a pickup driver last Sunday as they were out for a walk. The attack sparked outrage across the country, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau calling it a terrorist act. That was the worst incident against Canadian Muslims since 2017, when a gunman killed six worshippers at a mosque in Quebec. Political analyst and commentator Jason Unruha says that hate-motivated attacks are on the rise due to a demographic change in Canada.
Increase. I think there's definitely a trend here. This is becoming increasingly more common. This has been something that has been building for some time. As the demographics switch in Canada due to immigration, there's going to be this kind of resentment, this perceived replacement. There has been fundamental shifts within the Conservative Party of Canada, who have used to be called the Progressive Conservative Party, but are now the Conservative Party. And they've been taking many harder right-wing stances, anti-immigration, anti-pro-choice, a lot of these very scary Americanish type of policies. It's quite frightening when we look at it.
Now, in France, marches have been held against the rise of a racist far right and in defense of liberties. Protesters fear the impunity of Islamophobic and racist militia, and they're asking the government to take measures instead of copying far-right topics. Our correspondent from Paris has the story.
Against the racist and Islamophobic far-right, in defense of public and individual liberties, that's the main slogan of 140 marches that took place all over France, organized by more than 100 organizations and associations. The protesters say there is an urgency to stop the rise of far-right militias and parties in France that act more and more openly and in full impunity.
It's the first time that we see people producing videos with their threats and using real bullets in a killing setup. We didn't realize the nature of the danger that's rising in our country. The day after the video, the president of the republic's been slapped in the face. I think that now many people are aware of the gravity of the situation.
Earlier this year, thousands of militaries, amongst them dozens of generals, openly called for law and order against the danger of Islamization of the French society. Earlier this week, a known far-right activist posted a video where he steps with a knife and shoots with real bullets a puppet representing progressive activists and calling for the murder of journalists and the left leader Mélenchon. One day later, a far-right activist slapped President Macron in the face, shouting a royalist slogan. But instead of facing a danger of a fascist putsch, the French government was occupied in endless debates in Parliament and Senate about separatism targeting directly the Muslim community or in voting laws protecting the police.
The French government should be a barrier, but step by step it is becoming a bridge to the far right because the government is introducing in the public debate topics like migration and so-called separatism. There is clearly an authoritarian drift of the government, and all these issues pave the way for the far right.
The far right tries to introduce in France as a unique issue the Muslims and the insecurity. These are not the problems that we face. We face social and health problems. These are the real problems.
Protesters say that an authoritarian and racist drift in the French society is already taking place. This ideology is officially carried by the Marine Le Pen party. Instead of facing this danger, they say the French government is copying parts of the far-right program and is not making any concessions to the popular movement like the Yellow Vest protests. Presidential elections will take place in France in less than 1 year, and the odds of a racist and Islamophobic far-right leader taking the reins remain high. Chris Denant, Paris.
Iranian presidential hopefuls have faced off for the last time in a third and final televised debate show. Teamed with people's concerns, the three-hour debate required the candidates to outline their plans how to address those issues. Yusuf Jalali has more.
After a calm and respectful second debate, the third and final showdown between the seven presidential candidates in Iran was again an aggressive one, themed with people's major concerns. The third debate required the candidates to highlight their plans for improving people's livelihood. They in part outlined some of their agenda, but the theme got derailed when contenders once again made references to the current administration's mismanagement in a range of issues, from the 2019 surge in fuel prices to the dismal handling of the coronavirus pandemic.
Mr. Rouhani, I'm ready to have a debate with you about the coronavirus pandemic and any other issue. With regards to the rise in fuel prices, for example, we still don't know who is responsible. You have created structures and entities that play the role of a scapegoat.
President Rouhani doesn't know anything about economy. That's why he appointed Mr. Abdel Nasser Emati as the central bank governor. So, I'm running for president to solve the problems created by the incumbent president.
The showdown was not all hawkish. Candidates did seize part of their allocated time to be to the point and avoid the blame game. Some believe in opening up to the world as a way out from the economic woes. and others seek the solution inside the country.
We need to establish better ties with the world to be able to attract investments in our industries. We cannot close our doors on other countries and expect our economic problems be solved on their own.
Entering into some international conventions is a mistake. You agree to enter into the FATF, but then they will decide the next step for you.
We will use workable diplomacy to force the U.S. into complying with their nuclear deal commitments. In the meantime, we will not waste our time on a few countries when we have numerous opportunities inside our country and can trade with other parts of the world.
We can invest in our female experts to run our economy. Women must be the pioneers of economic and social advancement, but this great opportunity has been neglected.
My economic plan can be summed up in three main points. The first one is overhauling governance and fighting corruption, inefficiency, and discrimination. The second point concerns supporting underprivileged families and social strata. And the third is increasing production and boosting businesses.
Unlike previous elections, which were more of a clash of parties, this time it's a contest of plans. Plans that can extricate the country's economy from the current predicament and ensure a brighter future for Iranians. While many Iranians are still undecided on a single candidate, reports show that the televised debates have helped the public to narrow down their choices.
The three debates have definitely given the public a clear image of each of the candidates and who deserves to be the next Iranian president. Vital as it is, the third showdown was not the candidate's last shot to make an impression, as the short but fevered election season is still not over. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Welcome back to Aperture. In the first part of the program, we went beneath the world's oceans to discover what has happened to the millions of tons of chemical weapons that have been dumped in the sea since the early 20th century. Now, as we have entered the 21st century and forgotten the days of the war, real time bombs are ticking under the seas of the planet. The Baltic Sea, the most polluted sea in the world, is rife with tons of highly toxic and explosive cocktails of chemical weapons inherited from two world wars, which threaten us today. Stay with us for the second part of the documentary as we go across the Atlantic to see the legacy of two world wars all around the United States coast.
First of all, we are interested in that the fishing vessels and the fishing or the fishers are not getting injured by fishing that substances up. And therefore, we encourage them to, by having a regime here in the Danish area where we compensate them economically by paying, in fact, the same amount for the cost of the value of the fish they could sell on the market. Here we have the mustard gas in the middle of the fishes. That is something that has happened through the years, going from fluid to solid mustard gas. We have recent cases, both in Denmark, but also elsewhere in the world, where you see that the fishing vessel, the people that are dealing with the chemical substances afterwards are contaminated and injured. So we still find subjects that contains both chemical substances but also the explosive. We have a 24/7 365 response team ready to go out to sea and assist the fishing vessels that have caught chemical munitions. So that is the unique part of the unit here in Bornholm. The last chemical report that we have was in March this year here, so it's a couple of months ago. That's the only one this year. So compared to in the 90s, where we had more or less between 50 and 100 cases per year, it has gone down.
In recent years, deep-sea construction projects began in the Baltic Sea, and with them came fears that pollution could result with an accidental disturbance of the chemical arms.
The Nord Stream project is setting new benchmarks. The dual pipeline, which is more than 1,200 kilometers long and runs through the Baltic Sea, links the energy markets of Western Europe and the huge natural gas reserves in Russia.
We're in Lahnfurt, Germany. This is where the pipeline comes out of the Baltic Sea, and this is where the gas enters the European gas grid. The munitions issue meant that we had to do extensive detailed surveys. Once the alignments of the pipelines were defined, we then did the detailed munitions surveys. We did very high-resolution side-scan sonar surveys, magnetometer surveys, and bathymetric surveys. And then within the installation corridor, so that's where the pipeline could touch the seabed, we did gradiometer survey works and visual inspections. And out of those, we identified over 400 munitions along the pipeline route. To allow us to have a safe corridor, we had to clear munitions within plus or minus 25 meters of the Nord Stream pipelines. So prior to the installation, we cleared munitions through using detonation techniques in the Gulf of Finland and in Russia. And in Germany, we lifted the munitions that we found close to the route. We had located a number of chemical munitions, and these were avoided.
The Nord Stream gas pipeline had to be constructed around the dangerous zones because so far no European country has taken responsibility for cleaning up the chemical munitions in the sea. Americans who fought two world wars far from their own shores have now discovered a dangerous surprise close to home. United States officials now admit that thousands of tons of their own unused weapons were dumped by the military all around the U.S. coasts.
I was working on an investigation involving the local disposal of military munitions at the local bases when I saw photographs in the 1950s, the 1940s, and the 1960s, of barrels of mustard gas and lewisite and phosgene loaded up on barges being towed to sea. There are photographs of barrels of mustard gas being thrown overboard the military's records were very sketchy. They were scant. They were conclusive to a degree that they were quite sure that there were a number of dump sites, dozens of them, off of 11 different states in the United States, presumably off of some coasts of some other countries as well. That was an eye-opener. There are three chemical weapon dump sites the U.S. Army has identified to very vague degrees off the coast of Virginia. One of them is right off the coast of Virginia Beach here, where all these people are playing volleyball and laying in the sun. It is in very deep water, presumably around 12,000 feet or so. It's out near the continental shelf. That's where their records indicate this dump site was created back in the 1940s. They can't say with any degree of certitude if it actually is that far out. The reaction was one, I would say, of shock. It was shock within the U.S. population. It was shock within Congress. Congress had no idea this had been going on or that there were potential dangers off of their coastlines. That they were shocked that there was little in the way of active monitoring of these dump sites or in the way, as far as they could tell, of any research being done to confirm their locations or to find other ones that the Army fully admitted that they expected to be out there. They just hadn't have any idea where they would be.
In the wake of Bull's investigations, the U.S. Congress called upon the Army to increase its efforts to locate dump sites. That work goes on today at the very facility where the U.S. produced its massive chemical weapons arsenal.
My work here has been mostly archival research on when we started, why we started, where we started dumping chemical munitions. White binders are pretty much all of the information that in the last 5 years we've been able to find on the chemical weapons disposals and some conventional in U.S. waters. It is putting a puzzle together in many, many instances because you find a piece of correspondence, say that Edgewood's got some 4.2 white phosphorus rounds and some 4.2-inch mustard-filled rounds. We need to dispose of them. They are unsafe, unserviceable. They cannot be reconditioned. So you've got that piece of paper, okay. But all of a sudden you'll get a piece of paper out of Norfolk Navy. I go, wait a minute, now I know what they did with them. And whoa, we've got the boat. So we go and we find the logbook. And hopefully the captain put in the lat longs. You know, how long did it take him and when he went back to shore. Anytime that you find something that matches up, it's like I can only equate it maybe to a jigsaw puzzle with 10,000 pieces. How long would that take you to put together? I don't know. Don't want to find out.
William Brankovitz was the first to chart U.S. chemical weapons dumping at foreign and domestic sites for the U.S. Defense Department in the 1980s.
Part of the problem at the end of the war was we captured a great number of those chemical weapons, as did the Russians. And we all share some of that legacy today. Some of those chemical weapons were returned to the United States for exploitation to be looked at and to be evaluated and tested. But the rest of it was, again, thought to be excess to anyone's needs. So a great many of those chemical weapons were taken out to sea and were sea disposed at the time. That pretty much continued right into the 1960s. And in the 1960s, people became concerned about, is this really the way to get rid of chemical weapons? There were a series of chemical weapons disposals that were planned at the end of the 1960s. In an operation called Operation Chase. The last one was under a great deal of controversy. By that time, everyone had started to realize that there were potential problems. And so the Army asked the National Academy of Sciences in 1969 to take a look at this problem and do a study and see what the best way was of doing this disposal action. They issued it, and it basically said, due to the fact that we don't know completely how the fate of this material is resolved on the ocean floor, we recommend that you stop sea disposing of chemical weapons. And we moved away at that point in time completely from ocean disposal of chemical weapons. I think about 2 years later, in 1972, there was a congressional act that made it illegal.
The Pentagon began a pilot program to study environmental effects off the coast of Hawaii, where it dumped tons of conventional and chemical munitions over the decades.
I think we've all learned things, that the ocean is not a garbage dump, and if you dump something into the ocean, it does have environmental effects. When you understand that, today we're taking a look to see what those effects are. We're looking at the fish. We're looking at the other biota in the sea to see what effect it has had to determine whether removal is an appropriate course of action. What is down there has been down there 30, 40, 50 or more years, in some cases 80 years. There's a lot of work the environment has done on these munitions, and that work has been to slowly dissolve them and absorb them. And when we're not finding an adverse impact to health, life, safety, leave in place is continuing to be the right solution. I'm not saying that we won't find a location where we make a different decision. But when we're using a science-based approach, we really want there to be an understanding of the effect on the environment, an understanding on the effect on people, and an understanding of what happens when we bring it up out of the water. Is that really the safest, most risk-averse manner of handling this?
The United States and Great Britain have extended official secrecy until 2017. And for the last 60 years, scientific research on chemical weapons in the sea and the dangers they pose has been limited because of this military control. Canada launched a big effort to dispose of chemical weapons during World War II. One retired Army mine clearing expert has combined environmental concern with an entrepreneurial approach and become a crusader for cleanup.
Good afternoon, I'm Wendy Bergfeld, and this is Bain Street. And on today's program, a conversation with Terry Long, a former military engineer and explosive ordnance disposal expert, more than 30 years experience, and he is sounding the alarm. Our conversation on today's edition of Main Street.
I was born in Sydney, Nova Scotia, and I grew up here. Cape Breton Island is an island. We have a big lake in the middle of it called the Bedore Lakes. It's a very beautiful island, pristine in some areas. When you start looking at the Bedore Lakes, there's actually five munition sites, and one is a chemical weapons disposal site from after the Second World War. Johnstown was used for a chemical weapons facility. Everything was secret. They didn't want people to know that this was actually being manufactured here. It was the same thing after the war when they started to look at decommissioning. It was basically just tear down the structures and leave it. And there was, again, no knowledge that it was a chemical weapons site, so nobody would suspect anything there at all. So when I started looking at that, I started feeling compelled that I had to do something to protect our lake. And then when I started looking outside of Nova Scotia, again, I was getting shocked. All these different munition sites all along the eastern seaboard, all along the west coast of Canada, and all around the world, from the Baltic Sea to the Sea of Japan. The first thing I did is I did a Canadian Senate hearing, and I took the First Nations of Wagobok with me so we could actually talk about it from the perspective of First Nations, as them being the keeper of Mother Earth. So at the Senate hearing, we discussed the different sites, what some of the contaminants are. Two recommendations came out. The first was the United Nations should have an international conference to address sea dump munitions. The second was is we needed to develop a stakeholders group that encompassed everybody to actually look at the effects from the munitions. So what happened is because there was no international conference, I developed the International Dialogue on Underwater Munitions, and that became the International Platform for Munitions.
My name is Albert Marshall, and I am from the Moose Clan. I am from Mi'kma'ki, the Mi'kmaq territory, back during the war. We used to see these planes going back and forth. As a matter of fact, there was a lot of bombs dumped into the Bedore Lakes. Terry Long informed me of what compounds that these bombs had. Because in a lot of our observations, we used to see a lot of unusual lesions in some of these aquatic life. Personally, I've had 6-7 members of my immediate family that have died from various strains of cancer. And even as we speak, I have a granddaughter at the Children's Hospital in Halifax with cancer. Bedore Lakes has been a lifeline for our people for so long. Factoring our 7 generations, we have to also ensure that our future generations will also have the same privileges as we have today.
Canadian authorities had never admitted that chemical weapons were dumped in the Bedore Lakes, but they haven't denied it either, and for Terry Long, that silence speaks volumes. Concerns that dump sites cannot be cleaned up without injury to humans and damage to the environment has hindered such efforts. But Japanese officials, pushed by economic interests, decided to move ahead. They founded the first industrial program to clean up chemical weapons in the seas. Imperial Japan produced large quantities of weapons containing mustard gas and lewisite in the 1930s. They used them against civilians during the invasion of Manchuria in 1937, killing thousands. Poison gases were produced here at Okunoshima Island. The work was so secret the island was removed from Japanese maps during World War II. Today the island is called Bunny Island. The bombs in the Kanda port lie just 10 meters deep, and the Japanese government negotiated a contract with Kobelco, a giant steel corporation, to clear the weapons and destroy them. Kobelco technology is beginning to interest other countries like the United States, Belgium, and France. The Kanda experience and Kobelco's cutting-edge research with underwater robotics demonstrates safe cleanups can be conducted in depths of up to 150 meters safely for humans and the environment. One million tons of chemical weapons lie in the depths of the seas. Some have been there for more than 70 years now. Most countries clearly don't want to take responsibility for cleaning up their own weapons, and many other munitions belong to no country. For example, who will pay for the weapons made by Germany during World War II and dumped by the Allies? The Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, which won the 2013 Nobel Peace Prize, has a mandate to end the spread of chemical weapons around the globe. Since 1992, 190 countries have signed the convention prohibiting chemical weapons. However, the OPCW has never taken a stance on the issue of munitions dumped in the sea. Terry Long, with the support of Baltic state officials, brought his group and the problem to The Hague last spring to urge the organization to support cleanup efforts.
Good afternoon. I'd like to welcome everybody here today to this side event at the LIPA room. My name is Terence Patrick Long. I'm the chairman of the International Dialogue on Underwater Munitions. What is desperately needed is ownership and leadership and the coordination of international efforts to adequately address sea dump chemical munitions.
We think that time is really ripe to act, because weapons are surfacing and calling for action. We are truly convinced that the member state of the OPCW will finally listen to us.
Every now and then people are asking us, is the leakage increasing or not, or is the environmental damage ongoing? We cannot answer them with the degree of certainty we would like to have.
The worldwide dumping of C-dump chemical munitions by the international community was a mistake. We all seriously need to accept the obvious, that substances that are too toxic to touch with the ungloved hand has no place in our marine environment.
It's urgent that scientists be free to continue their research. The military secrecy imposed by the Allies since the Potsdam Conference in 1945 must be lifted. This is essential to effectively evaluate the risks these weapons pose to man, the environment, and the food chain.
That the states involved in creating this disaster will finally clean up and take responsibility for their previous actions before it is too late and the legacy of the world wars takes its toll on the world's next generation. Let's wait and see. And that's it for this week. Do join me again next time here on Aperture. Goodbye for now.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
This is
For a Better Life.
For a Better Life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, I have been sent to complete noble manners.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Dear brothers and sisters, you're welcome to For a Better Life with me, Javed Akbari. In this episode, I'm going to discuss ways of treatment of moral deviations. Of course, moral deviations are there, and assuming that you are deviated morally, now what are the solutions and how can we remedy deviation, the problem, the moral problem? And what are the ways through which the moral deviation can be treated? So, as I discussed in one of the previous episodes, we have two kinds of morality, individual morality and social morality. The moral virtues and vice can be concerned with both the social and individual aspects of our lives. Morality is indeed the bedrock in sustaining society. The maintenance of morality is the responsibility of all members of the society. Everyone living in the society is supposed to maintain morality, to observe moral laws, and to stick to moral values. And of course, morality means the observance of the principles of right and wrong conduct. Now, the erosion of moral values will cause degradation, degeneration, and more importantly, the erosion of social values. So, a society without moral responsibility would be even worse than anarchy. Society without moral value is bound to collapse. And some of the effects of immorality, to be brief, of course, are insecurity, insecurity of lives, insecurity of properties. And some of the effects of immorality is injustice, dishonesty, telling lies, hypocrisy, slandering, deception, and cheating in its various forms when dealing with others. Hypocrisy, envy, and jealousy are moral diseases, and a moral disease must be healed by a moral remedy. A disease permeates the entire environment, as a result of which the society and people are affected negatively. In our modern day life, we have a lot of evil. We have a lot of vices spreading in the society. Like, for example, the rate of divorce is increasing. There are abortions. There is robbery. There is theft. Killings and moral corruptions are there. And these are symptoms of moral sickness that destroys the community of human beings. No matter what those sickness and ailments are, they have to be curtailed. They have to be controlled and cured.
We were given so many prizes. We changed the desert into oases. We built buildings of different lengths and sizes, and we felt so very satisfied. We bought and bought and couldn't stop buying. Charity to the poor, cause we couldn't stand the crying. We thought we paid our dues, but in fact, to ourselves we're just lying. Oh, I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. Is it satisfied? Is Allah satisfied? Is Allah satisfied?
Now let's just get into some detail about moral virtues and ways of treating moral vices. There is no doubt that ethical problems do exist in every society, as I said. Whether a person lives in the society or all by himself, in the individual level or at the social level, moral problems and moral degradation is a common problem in some society. Moral deviations do exist, and we should treat those who suffer from moral deviation like a patient. We should consider them as patient. Moral deviation is a kind of disease, a mental disease, that sometimes can lead to physical disease and vice versa. Because if you are morally corrupt, if you suffer from a disease, moral disease, it will have some impact on your physical well-being as well. And the same is true vice versa. If you have a physical problem, a physical disease, then it will have some impact on your mental and moral well-being as well. Sometimes a physical disease leads to mental disease. In the same way, we should take the physical illness seriously. When it comes to treating a disease, we should always consider three principles or three steps in its treatment. Okay? First of all, in order for us to treat a moral disease or any kind of disease, whatever, whether it's moral, mental, or physical disease, there are three steps involved. First of all, the diagnosis of disease. We should understand what kind of disease it is. We should understand its nature, because the diagnosis is very important. Unless we diagnose a disease, we cannot treat it. This is the first step. And then the second step comes. The second step involves finding the causes of disease, whether it is moral disease or mental disease or physical disease. What are the causes? And of course, once we know the causes and once we know the disease, then the third step comes, ways of treatment of the disease. That's very important. What are some possible ways through which a disease can be treated? A disease can be treated. Of course, when it comes to diagnosing a disease, the physical diseases are easier to diagnose than the spiritual and mental diseases because they have more clear symptoms.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
For example, if someone is coughing, you can easily diagnose that he has caught cold. Or if someone is suffering from backache, you will learn that he is suffering from herniated disc. He has disc protrusion, for example. It is relative to diagnosis such problems because the modern equipment and facilities are there, and we can, through these, through the tools and equipments and facilities, we can easily diagnose those physical diseases. But when it comes to moral cases, moral diseases, moral deviation, it's very complicated. It's very difficult to diagnose the cause and first of all the disease and then the causes and then ways to treat. They involve complex procedures because moral deviations often have similar manifestations and symptoms, and there are some manifestations which are caused by, let's say, by a mixture of several more diseases, and their diagnosis becomes difficult. According to the scholars of ethics or the scholars of akhlaq and physicians, of course, we should carefully and patiently treat these diseases. And of course, the moral diseases have their own procedures, but they involve the three steps. The first step was to diagnose the disease. And then the second step is to find the causes. And then the third step was to find ways to treat the disease. These three steps have to be there in order for us to treat a disease, whether that disease is mental or physical or moral. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Your mercy, your love is all I need. So I need.
All I need.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.